The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
It's Election Day in Israel. Some voters fear that their secular way of life is under threat.
So we are scared. We are scared, even in Tel Aviv.
It's the beginning of the process, and if we don't stop it here, then down the road, we'll say, why didn't we stop it there?
Also, the U.S. and the Taliban were negotiating, but where do you go to meet with a group that isn't internationally recognized?
That's why they also agreed that the Taliban should have an address where they can find them, where they can meet them.
And Sarah Thomas becomes the first person to swim the English Channel 4 times.
And the current pushed me all over, and my mouth is totally raw from all the salt water.
Just wow. I'm Carol Hills. All those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. It's Election Day in Israel. Early exit polls are coming in, and it's looking like a dead heat between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his main rival, Benny Gantz. Both Netanyahu and Gantz's parties look to be on track to win just more than 30 seats each in parliament. That's far short of what either would need to form a government on their own. Official results are expected tomorrow. It's the second national vote in less than 6 months. The World's Matthew Bell is on the ground in Israel and has been talking to a range of voters.
If there's an emotion that captures this campaign season, it's fear and loathing. That is a last-minute plea on the morning of Election Day here in Tel Aviv against Benjamin Netanyahu. It's an SUV with giant speakers on the roof, signs on the side that say Crime Minister, and an Israeli flag on the back. It says, I have no other country. Full disclosure, I'm going to simplify and generalize here, but let's break down the handful of major political camps and listen to what they're most anxious about. Tel Aviv is a bastion for secular liberals. They call it the bubble, beaches, nightlife, cafes. But lots of Tel Avivis feel that their way of life is under threat from the religious right. Gal and Meital Zahavi worry that freedom of religion, especially the freedom to not be religious, is slipping away in Israel, along with basic human rights for Jews and Palestinians.
We are scared. We are scared, even in Tel Aviv.
Because it's the beginning of the process, and if we don't stop it here, then down the road, we'll say, why didn't we stop it there?
Baba.
One of the rising political stars for the secular left is Stav Shafir. She was surrounded by supporters when she showed up to vote at a Tel Aviv polling station. Shafir told me her supporters have plenty to fear.
Most Israelis want to have, you know, gay marriage, civil marriage, public transportation on Saturday, freedom to live your life, live your religion, spirituality or non-religion the way that you want. The government is doing something completely different. And slowly people start to feel that it's becoming insane.
The ultra-Orthodox religious camp is scared too. A campaign message from Shas, one of the two big ultra-Orthodox parties, says they won't trample the Sabbath. Give them an answer at the ballot box. Shas activist Avraham Yitzhakov pointed to a group of left-wing activists across the street waving rainbow flags and said they are the problem.
They don't want Judaism. They want to erase Judaism, but this is a Jewish country.
The next political camp is made up of national religious Jewish Israelis. That's a broad group that Netanyahu has relied on to stay in government for 13 years. It includes supporters of his Likud party, along with hardliners from the far right who favor tougher policies toward the Palestinians and annexation of the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
Whatever the election results are tomorrow, may it be the best thing for the nation of Israel, for the state of Israel, and for the world.
Tzvi Neumann is an American-born Israeli who's been living here for 30 years. His biggest worry would be a left-wing government coming to power and giving the Palestinians a state of their own on what he considers to be God-given land.
There is no more central place to the land of Israel than Judea and Samaria. That's the core of the land of Israel. And without that, you know, it's the same as America basically giving up Arlington National Cemetery and Philadelphia and all of the central places that where America was born.
The other big political camp would be those people of Palestinian descent. They're a diverse group, too. Several million of them cannot vote because they're not Israeli citizens. In the de facto Palestinian capital of Ramallah, Hala Abdelrahman tells me that she remembers well the last time she was able to vote in a Palestinian national election. That was 2006.
Taban! Sure! Sure.
Did you feel enthusiastic, hopeful?
I feel I have a home.
Tell me, are you jealous in Tigayrani and official Antichabat that we have no elections?
Sure, we have a democracy.
Do you think you'll have a chance to vote again in the future?
Maybe.
And are you hopeful about that?
Till now, no.
Ahmed Hanoun is an official with the Palestine Liberation Organization. He says whether they like it or not, Palestinians in the occupied territories will feel the impact of Israel's election. We're in the worst possible scenario, Hanoun told me. Netanyahu is talking about annexing one-third of the West Bank. The Americans seem to be willing to go along with this. And if Netanyahu wins, Hanoun says, it's a crisis for us. As for the 1 million or so Arab voters inside Israel, many of them feel targeted by the Israeli prime minister. Netanyahu supported legislation that downgraded the rights of Israel's Arab citizens. It's called the Nation State Law. And Yasser Falah, a dentist in Nazareth, worries it's only going to get worse if the right-wing camp stays in power.
Here, where you was born and your grandfather was born, it's not your country, in your land. What do you want more than that? This was a good law to make the Arab people lose the faith.
Falah says he's not willing to lose faith. That's why he was offering a ride to anybody who needed one today to get to the polls and cast their vote. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell, Jerusalem.
Democracy is messy, but activists in Hong Kong think it's worth fighting for. That's why a Hong Kong lawmaker traveled to Geneva this week. Legislator Tanya Chan pleaded with the UN's top human rights group to investigate police brutality against pro-democracy activists. Chan says police abuse of protesters and ordinary citizens in Hong Kong is rampant.
For example, a female first aider, she was shot by the police with beanbag rounds and blind one of her eyes. And recently, we can see that even an underage schoolboy, just a bystander, beaten up by the police with batons and suffer serious injuries because I visited him. And so far, after 14 weeks of protest, over 1,400 people were arrested. Over 2,500 tear gas cans were used, causing serious injuries to a lot of normal civilians as well as protesters.
So going back to your request by the UN, how did officials at the UN respond to your request?
I don't have very encouraging response yet, but at least it is a start. And we'll do more, especially as a legislator, we'll do more to communicate with the UN Human Rights Council.
But for the time being, isn't it correct to conclude that right now the UN officials are basically saying, you know, you're on your own. We can't really help.
Of course, I would say it is an uphill battle.
So basically saying, we're going to be polite and let you talk, but we're not that interested. China's diplomatic mission wrote to the United Nations in Geneva asking it to deny you accreditation. They called you a convicted criminal. Why?
I'm convicted due to my participation in the Democratic Umbrella Movement. Our case is now waiting for appeal. Our case will be heard in February.
The weekend protests in Hong Kong, they tend to start out peacefully and then they break down into chaos. I mean, we saw the photos this weekend of masked demonstrators throwing petrol bombs outside government headquarters. Do you think this is inevitable that the protests become violent, or is it a tactical decision to up the ante?
After all these weeks and over 100 days of protest, the chief executive, Mrs. Carrie Lam, finally withdrew the bill after all these weeks. And
this was the extradition bill
exactly
that ignited these protests in the first place.
Exactly. And at the same time, we have all four other demands, which is, I think, very reasonable.
But what about the issue of protests turning violent? Do you worry that the protesters are going to alienate supporters if protests continue to be violent?
There is no leader. Most of the protesters are very rational. They do correct their mistakes and they learn from their experience. And the most important element is the support from the public. So if the kind of violence or disturbing scenes keep on increasing, that would be more difficult for them to maintain the support. But at the same time, all these can be settled if the government responds to our demands positively.
So what is the end game here? Do you feel like the protesters should stay out there until the demands are met, even if it gets violent?
Well, frankly speaking, it's a question that I've asked my friends and other legislators. And I think the end game, hopefully, is the government can answer our demands positively. But what if they don't?
They certainly haven't so far. Except for the extradition bill.
I do agree that we are facing a extremely difficult uphill battle. Even if they can settle, kind of, you know, with quotation, settle the protest, now they can't keep the peace for too long.
Tanya Chan is a legislative counselor representing Hong Kong Island. She's a founding member of the Civic Party. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Carol.
Hers is an accomplishment for the ages. Yesterday, we told you about American ultramarathon swimmer Sarah Thomas and her attempt to be the first person ever to swim the turbulent English Channel four times. Back and forth between England and France, nonstop. Thomas completed this astonishing athletic feat overnight. The details of her swim are told in numbers. 54 straight hours in the water. 134 miles, one jellyfish sting to the face. Sarah Thomas talked to the BBC right after finishing in the dark last night.
Coming back from France the last time was definitely hard. It took forever, and the current pushed me all over, and my mouth is totally raw from all the salt water.
A GPS tracker made it possible for fans to watch Sarah's steady progress. Novice swimmers may have been a bit confused by her route. The currents made it impossible to swim the straightest, shortest line. Sarah's four channel crossings look like sweeping parabolic curves. And resting during those 54 hours, not an option.
You only have 10 minutes when you get to each side. But each time I got to the other side, there wasn't a beach, so I just had to touch a rock. And then try and tread water and eat something really quick and then start back off again.
Thomas wasn't alone on her quest. She had a team boating alongside, including Elaine Howley, herself an ultramarathon swimmer. Howley says 5 miles from the finish, the current shifted and Thomas had to swim directly against it. All the crew could do was cheer on their swimmer.
We know she's tired, but, you know, she just has to dig deep, and she did it, and she got through it. She powered right through that current.
There's one more thing that makes this English Channel record extra extraordinary. Thomas was diagnosed with breast cancer 2 years ago. Elaine Howley says that was part of Thomas's motivation.
She really wanted to prove to herself that she was still Sarah Thomas, the ultramarathon swimmer, despite having gone through cancer and chemo and all of that. This is what she really excels at, and so I think she wanted to make sure that it was still something that she could do.
And lest you think Sarah Thomas has immortal psychological powers to persevere, she too has human doubts.
I almost didn't go back when I got back to England. I thought I should just finish and quit. And my team said, guess what? You can do better. You can keep going.
Indeed, she could keep going. Sarah Thomas, the only person to ever successfully swim four laps of the English Channel nonstop. Just amazing. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The violence in Afghanistan continues. Afghan presidential elections are coming up at the end of the month, and the lead-up has been especially deadly. Today, a suicide bomb killed at least 26 people at an election rally for Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. Dozens more were wounded. The Afghan president himself was unharmed. Ghani actually continued delivering a stump speech after the explosion, which struck just outside an open field where the campaign rally was held. Ghani is seeking a second five-year term. The Taliban has pledged to step up violence to derail the election. And there was a second attack today, this one in Kabul. The Taliban claimed responsibility for both of today's bombings. This witness described a horrific scene in Kabul.
It was around 1 o'clock when suddenly a blast occurred at the entrance of the Army Recruitment Center near the U.S. Embassy. I saw people and human flesh in the air.
American forces, alongside their Afghan counterparts, have been aggressively attacking the Taliban in recent weeks. This violence has all been happening as a peace plan to end the 18-year war finally seemed within reach. President Trump has long said he wants to end American military involvement in Afghanistan. U.S. negotiators had been meeting with the Taliban for about a year. But earlier this month, after an American soldier was killed by the Taliban, the president said that negotiations were dead.
In terms of advisors, I took my own advice. I like the idea of meeting. I've met with a lot of bad people and a lot of good people during the course of the last almost 3 years. And I think meeting is a great thing. I think that meeting with, you know, you're talking about war. There are meetings with war. Otherwise, wars would never end. You'd have them go on forever.
Most of the meetings between the U.S. and the Taliban took place in the island nation of Qatar in the Persian Gulf. American negotiators have come home from Qatar now, but for some members of the Taliban, Qatar is home. How did that come to be, given that the Taliban is mainly an Afghan group? The World's Shirin Jafari has our story.
On a summer day in 2013, a group of Taliban men stood around a flagpole in Doha, the Qatari capital. They raised the Taliban's black and white flag, then lined up to pray. This was a big moment, a moment that changed how the West negotiated with the Taliban. The U.S. and others had tried several times before to sit down with the group, says Christian Ulrichsen of Rice University.
In 2008-2009, there had been attempts by NATO and U.S. officials to establish contacts with Taliban representatives in Afghanistan.
Later, in 2010, the British and Americans reportedly spent a year cultivating contacts that could lead them to high-ranking members of the Taliban. With the help of those contacts, they ended up identifying a man called Mullah Akhtar Mohammad Mansour, who they thought was a top Taliban leader. They paid him large sums of money to keep him interested in the negotiations. Afghan officials met with Mansour 4 times at the presidential palace in Kabul. But shortly after those meetings, they discovered that Mansour was no high-ranking Taliban leader. It turned out he was a shopkeeper from Pakistan. He took the money and vanished.
Those contacts had effectively fooled the U.S. and NATO officials into believing they were representatives of the Taliban, who walked away with large amounts of money.
By 2013, the Americans realized that if they were going to negotiate with the Taliban, they needed to know who they were talking to.
Many times they were deceived. They didn't know who represents the Taliban and who is not a real Taliban. And that's why they also agreed that the Taliban should have an address where they can find them, where they can meet them.
Dawood Azami is an editor for the BBC in London and has reported on the Taliban. He says the U.S. came to the conclusion that the group needed a political office, an address, where they could be found. And it had to be outside of Afghanistan, in neutral territory. Now, you might be thinking, what country would let the Taliban come in and set up shop?
Many countries were interested to host the Taliban or the Taliban's political office. Turkey, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia were keen to host a group of Taliban.
Why keen on hosting the Taliban? Azami says it's because it's a political investment. Helping Americans negotiate an end to one of their longest wars could really boost a country's image, both in the region and in the U.S. But it wasn't a given for any of the countries.
Turkey was rejected because Turkey is a member of NATO, and UAE and Saudi Arabia were considered too close to the Americans.
Qatar was neutral enough for both sides, and so the Qatari government offered the Taliban a fancy villa on the outskirts of Doha. Picture tan walls, large arched windows, Islamic architecture. That's where the Taliban men were raising the flag.
When they launched the office, I was there covering the story for the BBC. It was a big moment. And they told me that they hadn't seen this venue before, and they were brought and were told that this is your new office.
From the moment it opened in 2013, the Taliban political office was controversial. The Afghan government was outraged after the group raised its flag there. Azami says officials in Kabul feared the Taliban was forming a government in exile. But the office survived the controversy and became a place where outside negotiators can find the real Taliban.
So the members of the political commission and the negotiators have been living in Qatar with their families for the past many years.
Joining them in the latest rounds of talks was Taliban deputy leader Muhammad Abdul Ghani Baradar. Baradar was in a prison in Pakistan, says Javed Ahmed, who advises the Trump administration on Afghanistan.
He was arrested by the Pakistanis for starting a secretive negotiation with then Afghan President Hamid Karzai.
But now the Americans wanted him at the table to make sure that any deal would stick. The talks collapsed. President Trump called them off earlier this month, which makes me wonder, what's going to happen to Baradar? Is the deputy head of the Taliban going to remain a free man in Doha? I ask Ahmed.
He is at the moment in Qatar, as far as I know, and he will remain there, yes, for the foreseeable future.
Ahmed says the talks are not necessarily dead.
The talks will very likely resume. The question is not if it will resume, but when it will resume.
And if the talks do resume, at least the Americans know where to find the Taliban. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
If Rashid Taha was still around, he'd want officials to keep talking. The Algerian-born rocker was never afraid to speak his mind. Taha was a punk rocker for social justice. He spoke out against hypocrisy and anti-Arab bigotry. From the clubs in Paris where he lived to the stages he shared with rock stars like Robert Plant and Patti Smith, Taha also highlighted his North African roots. Rashid Taha died last year at the age of 59, but his label just released the posthumous record Je suis Africain, or I Am African. His tune Ansit takes us to the break. Extreme heat waves, drought, crop failures. They're getting worse as the planet warms. Scientists say we have to act fast.
If we do not change course by 2020, we risk missing the point where we can avoid runaway climate change with disastrous consequences.
Scientists warn it's time for action. Coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH in Boston, PRI, and PRX. The clock is ticking faster than we thought. If we want to avoid the worst impacts of climate change, scientists say we have to make some serious changes. The world needs to slash global carbon emissions nearly in half by 2030. Just 11 years to make those dramatic changes sounds awfully soon. But the deadline is actually even sooner. All this week, we'll be tackling some key environmental questions leading up to next week's UN Climate Summit. To kick off our special coverage today, the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler explains why we have to act faster than we might think.
Good morning, everybody.
Last October, nine scientists sat down at a table armed with a PowerPoint presentation.
Welcome to this press conference of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to present the special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees.
The presentation was pretty dry, but the content would end up making a big splash. The scientists laid out how much better off the world will be if we can limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius instead of a long-time international target of 2 degrees Celsius.
Every bit of extra warming makes a difference.
This is climate scientist Hans Otto Portner, one of the panelists that spoke that day.
The proportion of the world population exposed to climate-induced water shortages would be up to 50% less.
1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit would mean hundreds of millions fewer people would face extreme heat waves.
Up to 10 million fewer people exposed to the risk of rising seas.
Some of the world's coral reefs would survive. Crops would do better, too. The scientists also found that limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees is actually still possible. But the world would have to cut carbon emissions roughly in half by 2030 to do it.
If we don't achieve that target, it gets really hard.
This is Penn State University atmospheric scientist Michael Mann.
If we don't get to that first critical reduction by 2030, it becomes very difficult to see a way that we can limit warming below that dangerous 1.5 degrees Celsius.
After that UN report was released last year, the world had a deadline. And we started to hear politicians and activists talking about it.
We have no more than 12 years to take incredibly bold action on this crisis.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
We are less than 12 years away from not being able to undo our mistakes.
That was 2020 presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke, New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and 16-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg. Now, if 2030, which is just 11 years away now, is the deadline that nature has set, we humans have set another one. And it's even sooner, 2020, specifically a UN meeting in December of 2020, just 15 months away.
2020 is an important year on the path toward global decarbonization.
This is former UN official Christiana Figueres. She presided over the negotiations to reach a global climate pact in Paris in 2015. Countries made promises then about how much carbon they would cut. But those pledges don't get us anywhere near that 1.5 degree goal. And next year is when leaders are asked to make their next round of pledges.
So 2020 is the first time since the Paris Agreement that countries will come together to assess how much they've been able to do and how much more they can do.
In 2020, most countries are expected to submit more ambitious carbon-cutting goals for 2030, or say they're just sticking with the ones they've already got. That's gotten everyone from Prince Charles to the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, to name 2020 as a make-or-break year for climate policy.
If we do not change course by 2020, we risk missing the point where we can avoid runaway climate change with disastrous consequences for people and all the natural systems that sustain us.
Guterres is hosting a special climate summit next week in New York. He's aiming to get leaders to commit to ambitious new carbon-cutting goals even before that key 2020 meeting. Of course, here in the U.S., there is another reason why 2020 is a big deal for climate policy. You might have heard something about it, the U.S. presidential election. Even abroad, climate experts are paying attention, like scientist Nicolas Hoene at the Wageningen University in the Netherlands.
We are definitely looking at the election very closely.
President Trump announced 2 years ago he plans to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement, but a different administration could get the U.S. back in and take a leadership role in future climate talks.
And that's why I think all the international observers are looking very intensively into the U.S. elections, because that will determine to a large part what will happen in the U.S. and therefore also determine the appetite of other countries to do more or less.
If the wealthy and powerful United States won't cut its emissions by that important 2030 deadline, other countries will have an easier excuse for why they shouldn't have to either. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
Carolyn will be reporting all this week on climate change as the UN General Assembly opens and tackles the issue. In addition to the usual gathering of world leaders in New York, a teenager whom Carolyn just mentioned will also be there, Greta Thunberg. The Swedish 16-year-old started an international campaign of Friday protests, where students walk out of school each week to demand that adults do something about climate change. Thunberg has been spending her Fridays for more than a year outside of the Swedish Parliament. Today, Amnesty International presented her with its Ambassador of Conscience Award.
Activism works. So what I'm telling you to do now is to act. Because no one is too small to make a difference.
More than a million young people from more than 100 nations have taken part in recent school strikes for climate action. As guests entered the opening of a new exhibit at a museum in the Netherlands, they stepped over a red carpet in the shape of a swastika. It's striking, certainly, and that's the point. The exhibit at the Design Museum Den Bosch is called Design of the Third Reich. It shows how design helped spread Nazi ideology. Museum curators say they worked closely with the Jewish community in the Netherlands to address potential concerns, and they've taken pains to make sure the exhibit doesn't glorify Nazi propaganda. Visitors can't take photos, there's extra security, and free audio tours. Still, for some, that's not good enough. The Association of Dutch Anti-Fascists has condemned the exhibit. Hannah Luden is the director of the Center for Information and Documentation in Israel. She joins us from Amsterdam. Hannah, critics say the exhibit, which includes Nazi propaganda, is provocative and should be shut down. What's your take?
Well, I don't think they should shut it down. I think they've done their utmost to keep the exhibition, under control. What the anti-fascists are really concerned about is what we were concerned about to start with in the first place, which was, could neo-Nazis make use of this exhibition in a way that we would not like?
You feel at this point that they're doing enough so that neo-Nazis can't kind of appropriate this and use it to their advantage?
Well, I don't know. This is always a question, and this is a big risk which they've taken, and they'll have to make sure it doesn't happen. But you don't know whether they will succeed or not. I hope so. I do hope so. Because I do think it's important for everybody to learn more about the Nazi period.
Why do you think this exhibit is worth having? What do you think it can teach people?
Well, what I am hoping is that it will teach people exactly the questions. How did the Nazis manipulate the population to support them? How did they impress them? I think it's quite well known that the Nazis did, for example, with propaganda, with speeches, but they also did that with architecture. They did that with lots of manifestations. I think people should understand how these things work so they will not accept being manipulated again. And I think this is something the Nazis mastered very well. And I'm afraid we are still suffering under the same risks, even in our modern time, in spite of the history we all know.
In what way in modern times?
We know the effect of manipulation of big leaders. We know the effect of manipulation of rhetorics. But there is also manipulation of even churches, you know, churches which impress people because they are so small in a huge building impresses you to respect God in a different way. And not that I'm comparing churches to the Nazis in no way, but the methods of impressing people, making people want to belong to groups, making people want to belong to something that feels nice, that feels beautiful, that feels promising, is a danger we face every day.
We reached out to the director of the Design Museum Den Bosch. His name is Timo de Rijk. And he told us this: if you wholeheartedly want to be able to say never again, you must take time to analyze how the influencing processes worked at the time. He went on to say that the museum makes clear from the very beginning that it deals with a racist ideology. So if visitors to the museum know what they're seeing is racist, is that enough?
I hope they found some ways of measuring how people, what people learn in such an exhibition. And I think that's very important that we all, you know, we keep checking in to what extent the goal is being reached, because the material by itself for non-professionals is just, you know, just artifacts.
Do you think more museums should be having displays like this one to illustrate kind of tough historical lessons?
Well, I think museums have a very important role in educating adults about, teaching adults and educating adults about different aspects of our history, which people know too little about. But I don't think it's easy. I think it's a big challenge. And mainly I can tell them what are the risks. But I do know that it's important for us as societies to make sure people have accumulate more knowledge about our history, our common history, and especially about the dark chapters of our history, because, you know, the never again is a very important message.
Hannah Luden is the director of the Center for Information and Documentation, Israel. She's been speaking to us from Amsterdam. Thanks a lot, Hannah.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Snakes are scary, but for most of us, the fear is more hypothetical. I've never come across one commuting into Boston, for example, but in many places in southern Africa, snake bites are a real concern. Puff adders, black mambas, spitting cobras all produce deadly venom, and people who get bit need to be treated quickly. Now Kenya has a motorcycle ambulance service to help people in rural areas. The BBC's Tulip Mazumdar has this story from Nairobi.
It's 8 o'clock at night, and Geoffrey Maranga from the Kenya Snake Bite Research and Intervention Centre gets a call.
Are people safe or terrified? You have told them not to kill the snake.
A man in a nearby village has spotted a cobra up a tree.
Okay, we are on our way. Make sure you are within a safe distance.
Geoffrey is with a colleague from the Liverpool School of Tropical Medicine in the UK, Professor Nick Casewell. They want to find venomous snakes to take back to their herpetarium in Nairobi. They take their extendable hooks and thick gloves and head into the village.
So I can see the snake now. It's a very long red snake. It's coiled around a branch. They've got the snake onto the ground now. So you guys are literally stood there holding this, what's a spitting red cobra?
Red spinning cobra, yeah, Naja Pallida. This is the most common cause of serious snake bite in Kitui County.
This community is very lucky. Geoffrey and Nick managed to catch the cobra before it could hurt anyone. In a nearby village, Marta Nzazu Malatya sits under a beautiful old tree with her nephews and niece. She was bitten by a puff adder 4 years ago, losing her left leg from just below the knee and consequently her livelihood.
I was on the farm digging in 2015 when a snake bit me on my ankle. My body was completely swollen and turned black. I was told I would have to have my leg amputated. I can't work or fend for myself anymore.
Her experience is a sadly common one here. She wasn't able to get to a hospital which could treat her fast enough. But it doesn't have to be this way. A pilot scheme is underway here, testing out new snakebite ambulances which can get into difficult-to-access areas quickly and get people to hospital fast.
Almost always, the biggest problem that leads to the loss of lives and loss of limbs is because of the distance.
That's Cecilia Ngare. She's a nurse from Kenya's new Snakebite Research and Intervention Centre. A major part of Cecilia and her team's work here is ensuring communities know about the ambulances and teaching people basic snakebite first aid. It's a sunny Friday afternoon and about 100 people have come from surrounding villages to learn all about snake bites.
They're demonstrating to me what they normally do when they're bitten by a snake.
And this woman has taken a scarf off and tied it up around her ankle.
Yes, and they do that to prevent the venom from going up the body.
Which is the wrong thing to do. So next, Cecilia shows them the correct way to give snakebite first aid.
So first we use the shawl to immobilise the whole limb, and then we use two sticks on both sides of the leg just to make sure the leg is completely immobilised. When we have movement, the venom tends to move more faster into the system.
The day has been a success. Cecilia and her team hand out their mobile phone numbers so people can call them if someone is bitten. If the pilot scheme, which is funded by the UK government, is a success, it could be rolled out in other parts of the country very soon.
The BBC's Tulip Mazumdar reporting there. You're with the world. Now for an historic first in the world of sports. Fans of the NBA champion Toronto Raptors basketball team can walk into the official merchandise store and buy T-shirts, hats, jerseys, and hijabs. The Raptors said the new gear was inspired by a local sports club for female Muslim athletes. The club is called the Hijabi Ballers. They organize weekly basketball nights as well as tennis classes and other programming in the Toronto area. Emreem Kadwa founded the group. She says she got the idea after she started playing rugby and didn't see other players who looked like her.
over the past 5-6 years that I played rugby, I didn't see a lot of people that wore hijab, especially older people that I could look up to as role models in the sport and just in other sports in general. And that kind of made me curious as to if there really is a community of Muslim female athletes in Toronto, and if there is, how can we connect them together so we're not all outcasts in our own little, you know, communities. So I started Hijabi Ballers as just a way to connect Muslim females in Toronto that play sports. But the response was so overwhelming that as we grew and as people found out about us, there was this demand for sports programming that was targeted for Muslim women and just, you know, a space where Muslim females can play sports, feel comfortable, feel welcome, and not feel like they have to give up their identity to play.
What was your response when you heard that the Raptors were now offering hijab?
It was super positive. They reached out to me before the launch and really wanted our group to be incorporated into the launch of the Raptors Nike Hijab. So it really says from their organization, like, we see you, we support you, and we want to create a space where you feel welcome.
What does the Raptors branded hijab look like?
It's a Nike hijab with a Raptors logo on it. The thing with athletic hijabs is it's meant to stay secure on the head without pins or anything that can injure the athlete while playing, especially contact sports. So the Raptors embellishment on the hijab is pretty cool too. And it kind of just makes us proud to be Raptors fans, makes us proud to be Muslim, makes us proud to be athletes.
I'm curious the kinds of challenges Muslim girls and women face when they're looking to get involved in sports, because I know that sort of motivated you to start the Hijabi Ballers.
In Toronto, one of the big challenges that Muslims, but not just Muslims, but like a lot of immigrant and newcomer families face is accessibility to sports in terms of financial accessibility mostly, but also just access to knowing like where sports programming is held and things like that. And with Hijabi Ballers, we try to create sports programs that are financially accessible, that are, most of them are free. And it's just about creating a space where Muslim females feel comfortable and welcome to go play. Another thing that a lot of Muslim communities face, I think, is cultural taboo towards girls playing sports or just girls.
And is that taboo among Muslims in Toronto, or is it more a perception by non-Muslims that if someone wears a hijab, they must not be interested in sports?
There's two things. There's a perception among like the older generation of Muslims in Toronto that, you know, they're this Canadian dream of coming to Canada and having your kids go to school and all of that. Like, that didn't include sports. So for their kids to take part in sports, it's suddenly like, oh, like, why aren't you studying, or why aren't you going to school? Or like, sports isn't seen as something that's valuable. So that, there's that perception that we're trying to change, and we're really trying to include parents in the conversation of why sports is beneficial to kids and adults and everyone, really. And then the other perception of non-Muslims towards Muslim females wearing hijab, I think that's more so this idea that like non-Muslims or just people that are not part of this Muslim female athletes community, they don't know that there are Muslim hijab wearing athletes that play sports. So they automatically think, oh, that person must not be good, or they don't know what they're doing, and like that kind of perception. So there's two different ones, I think.
How important is it for young athletes to see other Muslim women role models in sports?
So, so important. I think representation is the most important thing for young people to see growing up, and even older people, honestly. I think representation in sports media is one of the key things that we can do as a society to grow Muslim females in sports. You know, that saying, if you can't see it, you can't be it, right? So Muslim girls need to see other Muslim girls play sports for them to realize that that's something they can do as well.
Emreen Kadwa is the founder of the Hijabi Ballers, an athletic club in Toronto for Muslim women and girls. Thanks a lot, Emreen.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you don't have kids or haven't been a kid recently, let me initiate you into the world of Pokemon. Ash Ketchum is the superstar hero of the cartoon series. Since 1997, the character has traveled far and wide, competing in Pokemon League tournaments and losing. But now, after 22 years of cartoon defeats, Ash Ketchum's dream of becoming a Pokemon master has finally come true. And his win in the latest episode is giving fans a happy lesson in perseverance. The BBC's Michael Baggs tells us more.
Right, Snorlax, Mewtwo, Magikarp. Might sound like jargon to some of you.
Beak.
Although most will know this guy.
Pikachu!
Yeah, we're talking Pokemon.
I wanna be the very best, like no one ever was.
After 22 years, Ash Ketchum has realised his dream of becoming a Pokemon master.
Pikachu, use Thunderbolt!
If it wasn't you, surely you've seen a sibling or friend caught up in all the hype. From Pokemon cards to the computer games and animated TV shows, tracking Ash's journey to become the best trainer of the fictional creatures.
Pikachu, full tackle, go!
And it's not only Ash who's celebrating 22 years of hard work. Here are two people who've watched every step of his journey.
My name's Laura. I work full-time as a video game critic. I am 28 years old and I currently live in Surrey.
I'm Jake. I'm 27. I work for an internet company in Bromborough in the northwest on the Wirral.
There was something about the collection nature of Pokemon that really drew me in. It's that whole catchphrase, gotta catch them all.
And this idea of just, you know, carrying around all these powerful creatures with you and going off on an adventure. I mean, it's quite a beautiful like element of escapism in there.
Just perseverance. If you keep trying at the things you want to do, they're attainable. You just have to keep putting the work in and keep believing that this thing I want to do, if I keep working, I will get better.
You know, looking at the show, it's a wonderful piece of closure. It's brought everything full circle with all these people who have been watching the show since it began.
The BBC's Michael Baggs on the Pokemon beat. Looking ahead this week, we'll be spending a lot more time talking about our planet, digging into how countries are trying to come together to combat climate change. World leaders are tackling the issue next week in New York at the UN General Assembly. Tomorrow, we explore this question. How much does it really matter that the U.S. intends to withdraw from the Paris Climate Agreement? And later in the week, we'll be covering a day of action, massive climate strikes taking place across the globe. That's our show for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.